Chapter 55. The Alsace-Lorraine Booty. The first territory to be amputated from Germany at the Versailles Treaty would be Alsace-Lorraine, Elsass-Lothringen. It had been recovered by Germany in 1871, but Germanization had not been forced on its inhabitants. The choice had been left to them to remain French if the idea of joining the German Empire did not appeal to them. The results were in favor of Germany. Less than one-fifth wanted to remain citizens of the French Republic. Even the anti-German Tardieu had to recognize 360,000 inhabitants of Alsace-Lorraine, against 2 million, declared their wish to remain French. The position was the same in 1914. Men from Alsace-Lorraine had not flooded the recruitment centers of Poincaré, only 14,000 had volunteered to serve the French government, not even enough for a division. The rest of the population had served with distinction in the German army from 1914 to 1918. The most famous of them was Captain Schumann, who was to become after World War II the founder of a unified Europe, this time as a French citizen. He would be backed by a fellow former German, from the Tyrol, Alcide de Gasperi, now an Italian citizen, and fellow World War I German combatant Konrad Adenauer. Poincaré had made Alsace-Lorraine the base of his political career. He had made of it an emotionally charged issue, devoid of reason or knowledge. To recapture Alsace-Lorraine, he had sent 11 to 12 million young Frenchmen into the hell of the Western Front to be slaughtered. He was now determined to grab these German lands regardless of their history or the people's wishes. How would Poincaré respect the terms of the armistice? Wilson's 14 points had never mentioned the wrongs to be righted in connection with Alsace-Lorraine. Here is what was mentioned somewhat ambiguously, as reported by the American delegate, Dr. Homer Haskins, What Did Happen, page 12. The Allies had accepted the 14 points as the basis for peace. The points did stipulate the restitution of Alsace-Lorraine as well as the restoration of Poland, but also condemned the exchanges of population and their transfer from one country's rule to another without their consent. At the same time, the points proclaimed the right of people to self-determination. The de-annexation or re-annexation of Alsace-Lorraine should therefore have been preceded by a plebiscite. Clemenceau and Poincaré entered Strasbourg as victors with bands playing and flags flying. People came out to see the victors and watch the parade. Clemenceau and Poincaré shouted at the sight of the crowds, the plebiscite had been decided. The British were concerned, as early as 1917, about French claims to Alsace-Lorraine for one reason. The German will to continue the war would harden. If in the matter of Alsace-Lorraine the Allies persist in their present attitude, the war will not end in 1917 or 1918. Philip Snowden, 1917. During the same year, Lloyd George had refused to attend a pro-Alsatian banquet in London for fear of compromising himself. On the 14th of July 1917, Lloyd George did not believe the question was clear enough in the minds of his fellow citizens to allow him to attend a banquet to which he had been invited by Alsace-Lorraine, French, representatives. Tardieu, Peace, page 264. Tardieu also touched on the American position. For the majority of Americans, the question of Alsace-Lorraine remained misunderstood. For them, it was a country where people spoke German, and that was enough. How many times have the Americans told me of their hope that France should be satisfied with an independent and neutral Alsace-Lorraine? Tardieu, Peace, page 265. Tardieu recalled a conversation he had had with Walter Lippmann, a member of an official Board of Inquiry for Peace, in August, 1917. The idea of a plebiscite was so deeply rooted in his mind, the notion of a French Alsace-Lorraine was so foreign to him, that he had invented a system of fragmented voting, cutting up the provinces in a dozen parcels. Tardieu himself would not hesitate to impose this system of fragmented voting on Silesia in 1919 in order to satisfy the claims of Polish politicians who were allied to the French government. Tardieu had mounted a gigantic campaign in the United States to change public opinion. For more than 15,000 meetings, wounded soldiers would be exhibited to attract sympathy for the captive provinces. The appointed head of this Alsatian lobby was a Jewish publicist called Daniel Blumenthal, who was supposed to move the houses and barracks to Tardieu's viewpoint. The campaign bore fruit. On January 8, 1918, Wilson, still as confused as ever, announced, "The wrong Prussia has done to France in relation to Alsace-Lorraine must be redressed in order that peace can be assured for the benefit of all." Although the term redressed was remarkably vague, Tardieu welcomed the statement, "Of all the Allies' positions on this essential matter, this has been the clearest and most comprehensive." Tardieu obviously did not interpret "for the benefit of all" to include the Germans. If Wilson and the American people did not grasp the complexities of Alsace-Lorraine, it was because none of the French politicians would reveal the secret agreements they made with Russia in March 1917, just before America joined the war. These agreements recognized all French claims to Alsace-Lorraine, both sides of the Rhine, and even farther into Germany if Poincaré so desired. Clemenceau's shout that the plebiscite had been decided without recourse to the ballot box had upset the Allies. They insisted the matter be dealt with by a three-member committee. Tardieu had great difficulty selling his thesis of a plebiscite without a plebiscite. "I thought our claim to Alsace-Lorraine would not be the subject of debate, and that the solution was obvious," he wrote. Tardieu, Peace, page 269. But for the other members, the solution was not obvious. Finally, the Allies gave up, acknowledging the fact that the French government had made their claim to Alsace-Lorraine a fait accompli. The Allies' disagreement with the French government was covered up in the treaty by a vague declaration stating that the two provinces had been reintegrated under French sovereignty. What about the German people of Alsace-Lorraine? Would their right to choose be respected? Would their right to remain on their land be guaranteed? There would be no question of it. The French government would recognize no such rights. In all other cases, the rule had been the right to choose to the benefit of the relinquishing state. But we have refused and eliminated that procedure. There is no right to choose in Alsace-Lorraine to the benefit of Germans. This right belongs to the French government, which can, by virtue of the treaty and the exercise of its restored sovereignty, confer French status only on real Alsace-Lorrainers recognized as such by us. Tardieu, Peace, page 271. French politicians would excel all greed in taking Alsace-Lorraine thanks to this exception to the rule. Article 254 of the treaty established that the value of all public assets relinquished by Germany in Alsace-Lorraine should be carried to its credit by the Reparations Commission. French politicians demanded categorically that Article 254 could not apply to Alsace-Lorraine. "I demanded and obtained," bragged Tardieu, "that in spite of this formal article, despite such enormous, German, government assets as the railways, the French government will pay nothing." The German iron ore mines alone had enormous value. They represented 75% of Germany's total production just before the war. But the seizure of German public assets would also extend to the private assets of ordinary German citizens. They would lose their businesses and any property they had in the region. "We had our right to seize all the assets of German citizens recognized. We now had the right to prohibit all German participation in private enterprises in the public interest, such as mines, utility companies, etc., as well as the right to cancel all German interests in the exploitation of potassium. German potassium mining ranked second in the world. Never before in modern history had private citizens been stripped of all their assets and belongings by the victors without the slightest compensation." The rapine outraged many Allied delegates. As if this were not enough, Tardieu established a system of customs without reciprocity for Germany. He enumerated the other spoils of victory. "We would be guaranteed to receive for 10 years, and at the same tariffs as the Germans, the electricity produced on the German side of the Rhine. We would have total ownership of the hydraulic energy of the Rhine bordering Alsace. We would have the right to annul private contracts, which is exactly the opposite of the general rules fixed in Part 10 of the treaty. We would also maintain on German territory the rights of Alsace-Lorrainers ranging from industrial property to literary and artistic. The British delegate Maynard Keynes described the situation precisely. For more than 50 years, Alsace-Lorraine was part of the German Empire. A considerable majority of its population speaks German. The country has been the center of some of the most important economic enterprises of Germany. Nevertheless, the property of Germans who resided in Alsace-Lorraine or who had invested in its industry is entirely in the hands of the French government without any compensation for them. The French government is authorized to expropriate without indemnity the German citizens and the German companies respectively residing and located in Alsace-Lorraine. The national, provincial, municipal assets including the railways and rolling stock went to France without indemnity. But while the properties were seized, commitments taken on their behalf, such as public loans, remained the liability of Germany. Thus the two provinces were freed and discharged, under French rule, of their debts before and during the war. In short, all the assets of Alsace-Lorraine, representing 50 years of German work and investment, were seized without indemnity. Each German of Alsace was dispossessed of everything but his debt. And yet there was more. The French delegates claimed control of the German port of Kehl on the German side of the Rhine in the state of Baden. They feared Kehl would compete with Strasbourg, which they had just acquired. Again the Allies were astonished by such flagrant demands. It took 5 days before the French delegates could put Kehl in their knapsack, wrote Tardieu. If Kehl, once the peace is signed, were free to administer itself, Strasbourg would definitively be strangled. We ask that for a number of years Strasbourg had the time to organize, and for that purpose the two ports should be under the same administration. There were many objections. Kehl was a German port and should not be administered by a French director. Peace, page 273. Finally, Kehl was submitted to French administration. The Allies had thought for a moment that the new masters of Alsace-Lorraine would be satisfied and their greed quenched. But Alsace-Lorraine had only been an appetizer. Victory over Germany meant for the French politicians the opportunity for vengeance and profit. Alsace-Lorraine had been on the politicians' platforms for 50 years. It was therefore normal for them that Germany be made to suffer to the maximum, and that they should profit to the utmost. After Alsace-Lorraine would come the main courses, Saarland and Rhineland. There would be side dishes in Belgium, Luxembourg, and even an attempt to spill over into Holland. All these claims had been launched melodramatically by Victor Hugo in 1871 at the Bordeaux Assembly, where he lamented the loss of Alsace-Lorraine. Yes, the day will come when France will rise up. In a powerful thrust, she will reconquer Strasbourg and Metz. Only these two cities? No, she will take Cologne, Mainz, Koblenz and Trier. French politicians had fed on these lines since 1871 and were waiting for the divine minute, in the words of Poincaré. 1919 appeared to be that divine minute.